Thank you, Kieran. And it was nice to hear Chris's summary of statistics. This is obviously a very important public health issue. As you can see from this title slide from SAMHSA, we want to make sure that we're dealing with behavioral health issue, prevention, treatment, and the whole issue of recovery was pointed out by Chris. The panel recognizes the importance of this, so I'm going to run through an overdose of slides, so appreciate that. I always like to start off with a quote from the president, who noticed that as we work to reduce substance abuse and the great damage it causes in our communities, will make our country stronger and our people healthier and safer. And a quote from Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of HHS, who states that at its very core, our work today is about improving lives and ensuring peace of mind. It's about getting the right care to the right person at the right time, each and every time. And this is very important for this topic because the essence of the issue of the misuse of prescription opioids is the how do we treat pain? And I always ask, how many of you are willing to suffer excruciating pain in the service of a zero availability of opioid medications? Okay, nobody raised their hand, and if I were in San Francisco, at least one person would raise his hand because, you know, sometimes people are into whips and chains, but the key issue is people aren't willing to do that. And this is an important theme. So as Chris pointed out, we have to deal with both sets of issues, the misuse of prescription opioids and the appropriate treatment of pain. My immediate boss, Pamela Hyde, notes that addressing prescription drug abuse remains a top public health priority. And as we've seen inconsistent progress in addressing the issue across the state, the key is educating the public about the serious health risks involved and ensuring that we are providing the necessary treatment to those who need it. Again, one of my previous bosses, Terry Klein, is here, and this was an issue that we tried to deal with it when he was there at SAMHSA. He's the Secretary of Health in Oklahoma. We have a number of strategies that have evolved in terms of increasing public awareness, and these are just some of the, there have been House hearings, there have actually been Senate hearings, FDA is involved, New York Times writes about it, USA Today. We have other strategies, and I'm sure Michael Botticelli will talk about the ONDCP's approach, as you can see the epidemic responding to Americans' prescription drug abuse. The strategies to stop the epidemic and improving PDMPs, ensuring access to substance abuse treatment, ensuring responsible prescribing practices, expanding public education, and building community partnerships. These are influenced by a larger policy. So I'm going to talk about the epidemiology and prognosticators, meeting the need from SAMHSA's point of view, health information technology and technical assistance, and workforce development, because that's an undercurrent. Do we have people who know what they're doing when they're using these very powerful drugs? It's a key issue. Now, Chris pointed out that the percent of people using pain relievers is about 1.9% of those 12 and over the past month. It's remained about stable over the past 10 years. When we look at those who are among our young adults, 18 to 25, you see the percentage is at 10.1%. It fluctuates, but it turns out to be a major issue. When we look at drug dependence of abuse in the past year among people 12 and older, marijuana, 4 million people admitting misuse of marijuana to the point of abuse and dependence, followed by pain relievers, followed by cocaine and then tranquilizers and stimulants. But the key issue is pain relievers are the number number two drug. When we look at where people get their medication, medication, 54% get them free from friends and relatives. So we're not just dealing with doctors and patients, we're also dealing with the culture. So any public health strategy, then this is an ideal public health strategy because you got to influence community behavior as well as the individual practitioner's behavior. When you throw in the other 14.9%, 15% to free from friends and relatives, you get an overwhelming majority of people getting it from the household. Now, Partnership for Drug-Free America has a nice little slide. It's an older person who is getting his pain medications. He looks into the mirror, and you see his face. He closes the medicine cabinet, then you see the face of a young person. The key issue: people pay for these drugs, they use part of it, or they use it on a regular basis, but other people have access to it. So no matter whatever strategy we employ, we have to deal with the cultural issue. Chris pointed out we've had an increase in heroin use. I won't belabor that point. The fact of the matter is heroin is an opioid. The drugs that we manufacture professionally are opioids. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to conclude an opioid is an opioid. There was one drug company, Tramadol, when it first came out, the drug rep approached me and said, well, you can't get addicted by it. It's a weak, new opioid receptor agonist. I said, weak? He said, yeah. I said, so what happens if I take more than the prescribed amount? Does it become stronger? Because my people, as a treatment provider, my people always figure out the math. You know, one pill won't do it, maybe two will. If two don't do it, maybe four will. If four won't do it, maybe eight will. And if eight won't do it, maybe 16 will. And in fact, that's what happened. So, past year initiating of specific illicit drugs, 2.4 million individuals with marijuana, followed by 1.8 million pain relief. Key issue for us to keep in mind. When we look at the mean age at first use of a specific illicit drug, we find that people start off with a wide range of substances. Pain relievers doesn't occur until later, in part because of issues of maybe availability. When we look at substances for which recent treatment was received in the past year for those 12 and older, alcohol, I always like to remind people about alcohol because alcohol's the drug, not that it's as powerful as other drugs, but anybody who's withdrawing from opioids will tell you, you drink more and you can take the edge off of the withdrawal. And as my colleagues at NIDA will point out, a lot of these substances operate in the same areas of the brain, so we need to keep this in mind. But we have 973,000 people who receive treatment for pain relievers, followed by marijuana. This is an important point. The legal status of marijuana will affect our public health efforts to deal with the issue of substance use disorders. I know this focus is on prescription drugs, but we have 20 states in Washington, D.C. that have given legal status to marijuana for allegedly medical purposes. And then, of course, Washington and Colorado have legalized recreational use of marijuana. And I don't know what your position is on marijuana. But the key issue is it's a controlled substance. It's legal under federal law, and it's going to be an ongoing issue. A recent Gallup poll reports that 58% of Americans now support legalization. And Americans 65 and older are the only age group that still oppose legalizing marijuana, although support among this group has jumped 14% since 2011. And the reason I mention this is because, remember my reference to the cultural phenomenon. We're not just dealing with legal processes, patients and doctors and pharmaceuticals, companies and pharmacies. We are dealing with a cultural phenomenon. So from a public health point of view, you need to have a comprehensive strategy. You can't simply rely on some instrumental solutions where we restrict doctor access or restrict prescribing. The culture drives some of the behavior. When we look at treatment for opioids, as you can see from this chart, it's similar to what Chris was pointing out. We've had an increase in treatment by jurisdiction. I won't dwell on that, but the key issue is that it's an issue. When we look at the ethnic breakdown, 72% of the individuals in the emergency rooms are white, 11.7% African-American. And other studies show African-Americans actually have decreased access to opioid medications. A number of studies demonstrate that. And that turns out to be what I consider a paradoxical effect of health disparities. If you are African-American, a number of studies show you show up in an emergency room with a pain problem, they give you aspirin. If you're white, you show up, they give you Tylenol with codeine. Flip side of that is you tend to have less problems with prescription opioid abuse, but you don't have less problems with heroin. So we need to address those. So there are a wide range of individuals. As you can see, 17.3% and 17.4% are individuals in their 30s and 40s. increase in the ED visits involving non-medical use. Other drugs, oxycodone was a major player back in the day. It's become less of an issue. Narcotic pain relievers are involved in a large number of suicide attempts. So in addition to overdose death, there is the issue of suicide. But most people don't get much treatment for addiction in the United States. 20.6 million people did not receive specialty treatment. Only 2.5 or 10.8% of people who meet criteria for treatment got it. Again, back to a cultural phenomenon, 95% of people did not feel they needed treatment, didn't make any effort to get treatment, and that 0.1% error, we just need to take into consideration. But the most important thing, people meet criteria for needing treatment, nobody says anything to them. They don't believe it, the community doesn't believe it, the employer doesn't believe it, the wife or the children or the husband, they don't believe it until people crash and burn. Then suddenly you need treatment. So, again, nice from a primary public health point of view, efforts to deal with these issues, getting the community to recognize that there is a problem. If we cannot get the community to recognize there's a problem, we're going to continue to deal with these cultural issues, which from a public health point of view is how people behave, what they do. Most of you are well aware of how important that is. When we look at people who did not receive treatment but made an effort to get treatment, 38.2% did not have coverage and couldn't afford costs. And our hope is the ACA will address that because coverage is an important thing. The same issue with regard to pain management. In many plans, it's cheaper to give you a pill than to give you physical therapy. It's cheaper to give you pills than to give you the access to the psychological strategies to deal with pain. So it comes as no surprise then that people develop dependence on this. And again, it's just not a simple matter. Remember Chris's point that many people who gravitated toward heroin started off with prescription opioids. So, and why do you have the prescription opioids? Most of the practitioners, even though their knowledge base may be antiquated, start off trying to do no harm, i.e. to help. And sometimes in our efforts to do no harm, we do harm. But the key issue is that we're trying to help people help themselves and prescription drug misuse. So we need to expand access and coverage to increase the quality of services, to use evidence-based practices, as was the point that was well made. We also need to use health information technology and increase our workforce. We support at SAMHSA the federal, state, and territorial tribal efforts to develop and implement new Medicaid, Medicare provisions, and market exchanges. We are working to ensure that behavioral health is included in all aspects of health reform, including parity and the 10 essential health benefits. I know the controversies associated with health care reform and the Affordable Care Act, but the key issue is mental health and substance use disorder services, including behavioral health treatment. We want to distinguish between the issue of the substance use disorder per se. Many individuals need assistance with behavioral health strategies. And pain management is a behavioral health phenomenon. The other issues are prescription drugs. And we're going to be able to monitor prescription drugs through some of these plans, rehabilitative service, laboratory services, which should include toxicology screens. But the other issue historically is that I'm afraid to do a toxicology screen. I won't get reimbursed, or I'm embarrassed, I am the practitioner, about the implications of that message. So we want to make sure that we have access. At SAMHSA, we promote the use of our block grants to address unmet needs to support recovery and resilience in every state. We oversee and certify all U.S. opioid treatment programs, and we use our discretionary portfolio to support direct services and to target underserved at-risk populations and health disparities. We recognize that there is some inherent flexibility in our block grants, and so the states can use these resources to deal with a specific issue such as prescription drug misuse. We support services already not covered by Medicaid, Medicare, and other insurance, and this is going to be an increasing issue with health reform. Health reform does not cover, the ACA doesn't cover everything, and that's a key issue. So we think in response to the ACA, the block grant funds can be repurposed and realigned to better address emergent and unmet needs. We have opioid treatment programs in most states. There are two jurisdictions, North Dakota and Wyoming, that do not have them. So back to Chris's point, if you want to deal with the problem, you need to be able to provide resources to address the problem. We have a society that's ambivalent about treating opioid abuse because we always saw it as heroin users. And as you can see from the multiple slides that you see from Chris and myself, heroin is a problem, but it is not the larger of the two problems. We have 1,293 opioid treatment programs treating over 300,000 people. We also have data wave physicians, people, practitioners who can prescribe buprenorphine for the treatment of opioid abuse and dependence. And this is very interesting. There are 500,000 prescribing practitioners in the United States, but only physicians, but only 25,000 are data waived. And all you have to do to get data waived is take an 8-hour course to deal with buprenorphine. And, you know, I'm a licensed physician. I get terrorized periodically by my state boards wanting to know how much medical education I have. Have I had my 50 hours for the year? 8 hours, 50 hours. I got to do this, but everybody chooses something else because nobody has to deal with someone who's an addict. Not. So we have promulgated guidelines for opioid treatment, increasing availability of different kinds of practitioners. We have, in concert with colleagues at ONDCP, CDC, FDA, and NIDA, promulgated an opioid overdose toolkit to educate individuals, families, and first responders, prescribing providers, and community members about dealing with the issue of overdose. We've had over 23,000 downloads. This is an important issue. We have discretionary initiative, screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment. Are people asking about this? Got Ed Bernstein sitting in the second row, who's been the chief advocate for ESPRT, making sure that in our clinical situation we are dealing with these issues. And these are our discretionary initiatives, all of which can deal with this issue of prescription drug misuse. By embedding screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment of substance abuse problems in primary care settings, we can begin to address this. But we can also ask about pain management, how people are coping with pain, and what are they doing with this. And some of you are very young, and some of you are my age. I'm a senior citizen, and I have a bad knee on the left and a bad knee on the right, and an evolving bad hip, and all of those things really, you know, they hurt. So now the question is, how do we deal with those things? And I'm not alone in that. We're going to have 70 million people over the age of the baby boomers, over the age of 65 in short order. So pain management is going to be a major issue, and we need to help people with solid strategies. ESPRT works, getting people to address risky behavior. They will change their behavior. But if we don't ask, they don't talk about it. We have at Center for Substance Abuse Prevention strategies to address risk and protective factors associated with the non-medical use of prescription drugs, strategies and interventions by reducing non-medical use that we've promulgated. We have treatment improvement protocols that we promulgate for opioid addiction and opioid treatment, as well as medication-assisted treatment. We use our in-rep process to get the community to make recommendations for evidence-based practices so that we can address a host of these issues. And our part of our effort is to make sure that we do have evidence-based practices out there. And if we do not, then again, we're doing a lot of talking. Because as with the marijuana stuff, our communities rebel. We are seen as, shall we say, King George's Hessians, trying to tell the rebels what to do, since we're in Massachusetts here. The key issue is that if we can't convince the public that we can help them deal with this problem, they will see us as the problem. And that's an important issue, as with marijuana, as with pain medication. Health information technology may be a critical tool in the public health response. With technology infrastructure expanding, with patient-centric health information exchanges, we will be able to track a lot of information about prescription use and the underlying conditions which give rise to the need for the prescriptions. We're collaborating with public and private partners to expand and enhance our capacity with technology-assisted care grants. We've got Kim Johnson from University of Wisconsin, our NIATX group. How do you get people to work with the healthcare practitioners? We've given grants to OTPs to adopt and upgrade certified electronic health records. We've given grants to support PEMP interoperability. One of the problems with many prescription drug monitoring programs, they stop at the border. Now, you get a big state like Tennessee, surrounded by a host of other states, or Kentucky, or Massachusetts, and how much effort does it take to go from one city in one state to another city in another state? We're also promoting open source module development so that we can increase awareness. Facilitating healthcare provider access to PDMP data enables prescribers and providers to be better informed. But a larger issue is electronic health records. When you've got interoperability in our electronic health records talking to each other, we will be able to, again, make things relevant by making sure we have access to information. I'm getting the hook, but before I stop, we're also working with our colleagues in the American Society of Addiction Medicine so that people will have a better understanding of how to approach individuals, how to facilitate clinical decision-making, because these are also issues with pain. Our ATTCs are actively involved in training the workforce because we need a workforce that is involved. The physician clinical support system, medication-assisted treatment, we want practitioners not only to identify pain as an issue, but also how to do treatment. We want to increase access to addiction medicine. We don't want to cause suffering as we try to strive to alleviate it. So this, I think, is a very important public health issue. It goes well beyond simply dealing with the drug. It is dealing with how people are treated and how we deal with the cultural aspects of these issues. Thank you.